Welcome to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. On December 17, 1791, the U.S. Bill of Rights was ratified. In honor of this, today we'll be focusing on civil liberties in our show. Here's what's coming up. We'll be bringing you news from alternative sources, and we have quite a bit today, a recording by Stanley Longstaff from the recent D.C. Election Irregularities Report, an interview by Brian Gregg of Claire Abel from the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union, and a lot more.
This is Amy Antonucci with National News. The U.S. to adopt national ID. Homeland Security now in charge of regulations for all U.S. states, driver's license, and birth certificates. This is a report by Jonathan Wheeler. The United States Congress passed legislation December 8th that requires the states to surrender their regulatory rights over driver's licenses and birth certificates to the Department of Homeland Security. The massive U.S. intelligence reform bill weighed in at over 3,000 pages and, though unread by individual members of either the House or Senate, nevertheless passed all of the legislative hurdles needed in order to become law. Beginning in 2005, the Department of Homeland Security will issue new uniformity regulations to the states requiring that all driver's license and birth certificates meet minimal federal standards with regard to U.S. citizen information, including biometric security provisions. Added to currently existing federal laws and Supreme Court rulings, American citizens, when born, will be issued a Social Security number that will be included on their birth certificates along with DNA biometric markers. All birth certificates will also be registered in a federal government database maintained by the Department of Homeland Security. No child will be allowed enrollment to schools or be entitled to either state or federal government benefits programs without first presenting a certified Homeland Security registered birth certificate. Driver's licenses will also contain DNA biometric markers and include the holder's Social Security number and be required for receiving and applying for all state and federal benefits programs. Previous Supreme Court rulings have also upheld state and federal law enforcement authorities' right to request identification from any American citizen for any reason and at any time as not being violations of their, the citizens, constitutionally protected rights. Also included in this bill is a law to require the Department of Homeland Security to establish a separate ID system for citizens to use prior to boarding airplanes, and which some find reminiscent of the Soviet and Nazi regime's internal passport. We were also given this information. During the House debate, Libertarian U.S. Representative Ron Paul from Texas rose to the floor to denounce the bill, particularly the national ID provisions. He said, "National ID cards are not proper in a free society. This is America, not Soviet Russia. The federal government should never be allowed to demand papers from American citizens, and it certainly has no constitutional authority to do so. A national identification card, in whatever form it may take, will allow the federal government to inappropriately monitor the movements and transactions of every American. History shows that governments inevitably use such power in harmful ways. The 9/11 Commission, whose recommendations underlie this bill, has called for internal screening points where identification will be demanded. Domestic travel restrictions are the hallmark of authoritarian states, not free nations. It is just a matter of time until those who refuse to carry the new licenses will be denied the ability to drive or board an airplane." Next, from New York Newsday, New York City loses its bid to stop protest contempt hearing. Five appellate division judges on Tuesday unanimously dismissed the city's appeal to reverse a scheduled contempt hearing set during the Republican National Convention in August. During the convention, Manhattan Supreme Court Judge John Cataldo ordered the city to release protesters immediately after lawsuits were brought by the National Lawyers Guild, the Legal Aid Society, and attorney Norman Siegel. Cataldo held the Bloomberg administration in contempt for keeping as many as 560 protesters in violation of his repeated orders to release them. Cataldo repeatedly ordered the city back into court as his deadlines went unmet. Eventually, all detainees were released, but it took at least 6 hearings before Cataldo, who also said the city could be fined $1,000 for each person held after he ordered them released. The orders related to people held at least 24 hours and as long as 66 hours without being charged. We are pleased by this for historical reasons. It is important to reconstruct New York City's actions affecting the rights of protesters during the Republican National Convention, Attorney Siegel said. We will get our day in court.
This is Steve Diamond with some international news, starting with Italy. On December 12th, after 4 months of debate, the judges have decided that 28 policemen involved in the Diaz school raid during Genoa G8 summit are worth a trial. During the night of 21 July 2001, 93 people were seized and severely injured by police. In the same occasion, the media center and legal team computer were destroyed, and important hardware and files were kept without any legal mandate. The members of the police force have been charged with brutality, defamation, and perjury, but the crimes were at first officially confirmed as inconsistent. The preliminary hearings have now ended. Convinced by evidence, the judges decided to go ahead. In other news, U.S. Marines engaged in mock executions of Iraqi juveniles. U.S. Navy documents released December 14th by the American Civil Liberties Union revealed that abuse and even torture of detainees by U.S. Marines in Iraq was widespread. One Navy criminal investigator sent an email in June 2004 describing his Iraq caseload exploding with, quote, high-visibility cases. ACLU Executive Director Anthony D. Romero said, quote, day after day, new stories of torture are coming to light, and we need to know how these abuses were allowed to happen. This kind of widespread abuse could not have taken place without a leadership failure of the highest order. The release of these documents follows a federal court order that directed the Defense Department and other government agencies to comply with a year-old request under the Freedom of Information Act filed by the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Physicians for Human Rights, Veterans for Common Sense, and Veterans for Peace. The New York Civil Liberties Union is co-counsel in the case. The documents the ACLU released today, posted online at aclu.org, describe substantiated incidents of torture and abuse by U.S. Marines, including holding a pistol to the back of a detainee's head while another Marine took a picture, ordering 4 Iraqi juveniles to kneel while a pistol was, quote, discharged to conduct a mock execution, severely burning a detainee's hands by covering them in alcohol and igniting them, shocking a detainee with an electric transformer, causing the detainee to dance as he was shocked. Said ACLU staff attorney Jamil Jaffer, abuse of detainees was not aberrational. Other records released by the ACLU today include investigative interviews with Navy personnel that provide a glimpse into the routine abusive treatment of detainees by U.S. forces in Iraq. For example, in one interview, a Navy corpsman described the regular process whereby Iraqis classified as enemy prisoners of war would be taken to an empty swimming pool and handcuffed and leg-cuffed with burlap bags placed over their heads. They would then remain in the kneeling position for up to 24 hours awaiting interrogation. Despite providing this description, the officer stated that he, quote, never saw any instances of physical abuse toward the detainees. From the Palestine News Agency, Israeli occupation forces arrest U.S. peace activist and assault others. On Tuesday, December 14th, Israeli occupation forces arrested 4 international peace activists, including a U.S. member of International Women Peace Service, IWPS, during their participation in a peaceful demonstration against the construction of the apartheid wall in the village of Bilin, near Ramallah, witnesses said. Peace activist Ridwana from South Africa told WAFA that Israeli soldiers arrested U.S. activist Kate Bender Raphael while she was filming the Israeli attack. Kate has been taken to the Israeli Ministry of Interior in Jerusalem, where she faces deportation. An IWPS statement received by email said that the participants, quote, organized a peaceful protest against the construction of the illegal Israeli wall that began 2 days ago. The Israeli army is preparing to destroy the village residents' trees and lands in order to make way for the wall. At least 30 Israeli soldiers attacked the peaceful demonstration. They shot tear gas canisters and rubber-coated metal bullets, as well as beat up and arrested four activists, according to Ridwana. As Israeli occupation forces began arresting Palestinians, international peace activists were beaten and also arrested as they tried to intervene nonviolently. One international was beaten repeatedly in the legs and was unable to walk, the statement said. From the Washington Post, at Guantanamo, a prison within a prison. The CIA has run a secret facility for some Al-Qaeda detainees, officials say. Within the heavily guarded perimeters of the Defense Department's much-discussed Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba, the CIA has maintained a detention facility for valuable Al-Qaeda captives that has never been mentioned in public, according to military officials and several current and former intelligence officers. The facility has housed detainees from Pakistan, West Africa, Yemen, and other countries under the strictest secrecy, the sources said. Quote, "People are constantly leaving and coming," said one U.S. official who visited the base in recent months. It is unclear whether the facility is still in operation today. The CIA and the Defense Department declined to comment. Most international terrorism suspects in U.S. custody are held not by the CIA, but by the Defense Department at the Guantanamo Bay prison. They are guaranteed access to the International Committee of the Red Cross and, as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling this year, have the right to challenge their imprisonment in federal courts. CIA detainees, by contrast, are held under separate rules and far greater secrecy. Under a presidential directive and authorities approved by administration lawyers, the CIA is allowed to capture and hold certain classes of suspects without accounting for them in any public way and without revealing the rules for their treatment. The U.S. military, which controls the base, required the agency to register all detainees, abide by military detention standards, and permit the ICRC some level of access. Yet, Army officials investigating the Abu Ghraib prison scandal concluded that the CIA had held, quote, "ghost detainees" at the prison, inmates who were not registered or officially acknowledged, a violation of military rules. Asked about the arrangement with the CIA at Guantanamo Bay, Pentagon spokesman Brian Whitman said he could not comment on operations of other agencies. "The CIA facility has been off-limits to nearly everyone on the base," said one military officer familiar with operations at Guantanamo Bay.
We want a safer country, and it's in God we trust. So we'll bomb you during Ramadan, turn your world into dust. But pull up on your bootstraps, stand on your own two feet. As we blow them off with cluster bombs disguised as something to eat. We stand for freedom and prosperity. So we'll bomb your schools and hospitals, make sure you live in liberty. And all you evildoers, and your children and your wives, with our B-52s we'll show you how we value civilian lives. Give us your hunger, your restless, we'll show you democracy, a military trial, and detention indefinitely. We'll have homeland security, Thomas Ridge, all hail. We may not find the terrorists, but we can throw the left in jail, and we will all be safe, and we shall have no fears, once our retinas have been scanned, and all the walls have ears, and we're all in good hands. When the FBI is in the know, we're sure they'll look after us, just like they did with COINTELPRO. So hang a flag in the window, all hail to the chief. Follow the leader and suspend your disbelief. Our country, right or wrong, you know what to do. Sing, God bless America, that red, white, and blue. When facing anyone with box cutters, we'll say put up your dukes. As we spend $50 billion on bombers and nukes, we're a beacon of light. And just to make the point, we'll cut taxes on the rich and throw the poor into the joint. And we'll bail out the airlines, get out your green fedoras. And for all you laid off workers, we've got maquiladoras. Yes, capitalism will save us, for have you ever seen a more convincing proof than Enron in Argentina. So hang a flag in the window, all hail to the chief. Follow the leader and suspend your disbelief. Our country, right or wrong, you know what to do. Sing, God bless America, that red, white, and blue. The axis of evil will bomb them down the skids. There will be no more terrorists once we kill their kids. People may starve and economies may crumble, but those folks will just have to learn to be more humble and give us your money, debt repayments with aplomb, while we scour the map for a country left to bomb. And as another city falls on our sacred American soil, at least we've got our daisy cutters and that Alaskan oil. So hang a flag in the window, all hail to the chief. Follow the leader and suspend your disbelief. Our country, right or wrong, you know what to do. Sing, God bless America, that red, white, and blue.
You're listening to Making Waves on WSCA 106.1 LPFM. That was Hang a Flag in the Window by David Rovix. Dave wrote this song, he says, that he actually co-wrote it with his greatest muse and inspiration, George W. Bush. Which brings us sort of to the past elections and to our next report. Stanley Longstaff went down to D.C. for the weekend of December 6th and 7th. There is a convention on election irregularities, and he attended a number of sessions, including What Went Wrong in Ohio, in the Senate building.
A portion of the Help America Vote Act, and I would simply say this in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, that those who voted and co-sponsored and authored this legislation had numbers of good intentions. In fact, as I read it, I look that it has provisions for antiquated machine buyout. It has provisions for an election assistance commission that has no rulemaking authority. It has requirements for providing access grants and research grants to our states. The bad part about it, as the young Mr. Siegel said, we have no protection of the system of voting. And therefore, the system of voting broke down November 2nd, 2004.
That was Representative Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas. The system of voting broke down on November 2nd, 2004. This was the underlying feeling of people attending two separate events in Washington, D.C., on Tuesday, December 6th and Wednesday, December 7th. Voting in 2004, a report to the nation, and preserving democracy, what went wrong in Ohio, were bookends for the growing evidence that something is not right with the election on November 2nd and the voting process in the United States. The first was a forum held in the Dirksen Senate office building, and over 400 people attended. It was co-sponsored by Common Cause, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and the Century Foundation. This was a forum with multiple panels speaking to several different topics, looking at voting irregularities of the election throughout the country. Topics included voter registration, provisional ballots, machines, Election Day 2004, two different vantage points, voter suppression and intimidation, polling place operations and poll workers, and absentee ballots.
On behalf of the Leadership Conference, I want to welcome you to voting in 2004.
a report to the nation on America's election process. The 2004 election represented the nation's first real chance to move beyond the nightmare we experienced in the 2000 election. And today's conference will help us find out whether we actually did. Voting in 2004 is a look beyond the rumors and innuendo to find out what voters really faced this year when they tried to register and when they tried to vote, both before and on election day. Did the Help America Vote Act, which was passed in 2002 as the answer to the problems in 2000, really help Americans to vote? Or do we need to go back to the drawing board for some fine-tuning? It is clear that voters still face problems in getting to vote and having their votes counted. Many voters, for example, have problems in getting registered and being sent to the right polling places. Some voters were victims of voter suppression and intimidation. Some voters never got their absentee ballots, and many voters continue to face long lines at polling places due to factors such as insufficient poll workers and voting equipment malfunctions. The main purpose of today's conference is to allow us to carefully study just how extensive these problems were before we turn to what must be done.
The second gathering took place on the other side of Capitol Hill in the Rayburn House Office Building. This hearing, called by John Conyers, Jr., congressman from Michigan, focused on the irregularities reported in Ohio. Witnesses spoke about the problems that they experienced firsthand and told other stories that were relayed to them through various hotlines set up to report any problems on Election Day. Over 200,000 phone calls were received on November 2nd from voters in Ohio and New Mexico alone.
People for the American Way Foundation and all of you and the organizations today, we're not going to give up. You're not going to give up. We're going to have the public hearings. We're going to have the recount in Ohio. We're going to have the investigations. We're going to have the legislation and the litigation, because we're going to make sure the most precious part of democracy, the right to vote and have a ballot count, is protected. It's what it's all about. We want to share democracy with the rest of the world. We want to make sure the Ukrainians are supported, and how nice it is for the Bush administration to be saying such nice things about enfranchisement in the Ukraine. But let's hear it here, where we just had a dereliction of responsibility.
That was Ralph Neese from People for the American Way, talking about the election in the Ukraine, which was contested and thrown out based on the discrepancies between the exit polls and the vote count. People in the United States are looking at the exit polls before they were calibrated and talking about why this vote is not taken in the same way as the Ukraine vote. But more on that later. The issue of voting machines was also up for debate. The many different machines used around the country add to the confusion and inability for voter education. The lack of a paper trail make a recount or audit impossible, because these machines can only tell you how many votes were cast without any evidence to verify the vote. Nevada Secretary of State Dean Heller was a speaker on the panel and had this to say about machine manufacturers.
First of all, I believe that over the years, the vendors have been telling election officials how to run elections. They build the machines and say, these are your parameters, this is how you're going to run your election. And in order to make change, and frankly, I think Maryland does need to make changes, you need to have an election official that gets outside of that mentality, that will ask those questions. It will go up to Diebold and say, how many receipts do you print? If you don't trust your own machines to print receipts, why should I trust your machine? Those kind of questions need to be asked, but it has to come from the top. And I'll tell you right now, in the state of Nevada, every clerk and registrar in the state of Nevada opposed the paper trail when I announced it. Every clerk and registrar. And I guarantee you that the most of your clerks and registrars and secretary of states or election officials, whoever they may be, are opposed to that paper trail. And until you make a change in that environment, you're not going to see this sweeping across the country. Now, the fact that Nevada was successful, the fact that we had several hundred election officials come to Nevada in September during our primary And frankly, most went away impressed. The chairman of the EAC came to Nevada during our primary. He was impressed with the system and what was in place. So slowly but surely, the culture of election officials, I mean, go to their conferences and they beat the drum against paper trails. That has to change. And until that changes, vendors are going to continue to control the election environment that we see today.
The people of Nevada demanded that their machines have a printer installed or they would not buy them. And they did bring a machine to the forum, an AVC Edge, manufactured by Sequoia. And I had the opportunity to talk with Steve George, Public Information Officer for the state of Nevada.
Steve George from the Nevada Secretary of State's office.
And you're here with a machine that was used in the Nevada election process?
Correct. This is the new machine with the voter verifiable paper audit trail that we use in Nevada's primary and general elections.
Now, when I was watching people run through the machine, I noticed that there were multiple opportunities to backtrack to correct your ballot if you wanted to do that.
Yes, there are several opportunities along the way for you to go back and change up to the point of where you actually cast and finalize your ballot. Of course, at that point, you can't change it. But even at the point of having the printed record where you can look at it, review it, and if you want to still make a change, you can go back at that point, void that paper record, void it, of course, electronically, and recast your ballot.
What did the state do in terms of educating the public on using this machine?
Our clerks and registrars in Nevada did an excellent job. They worked with Sequoia going around. We did television, PSA. We went around and did a lot of demos for senior citizen centers and groups like that. So the word got out fairly well on how to use the machine. And our voters loved the machine. We had incredible feedback. Senior citizens, of course, many times get concerned because they think it's a computer. And as you saw for yourself, it's really not a computer. It's just touching a screen. Certainly it's a computer involved, but the voter doesn't have to worry about being able to use a computer.
I asked Steve George how the paper trail on this machine could be used in case of an audit or a recount.
What it does is it keeps the paper record there. You get to review it as a voter. It stays with the machine in case there's a recount, in case they want to verify how the machine worked.
So in terms of any recount or audit of the vote, then there's a paper trail that can actually be gone back to?
Yeah, there's three methods. One is the electronic version. You could recheck the electronic version. Second, there's a barcode on the paper that would has the votes in there, just like you would in a supermarket when you buy a can of peaches. It reads the machine. And the third one is you could obviously go through manually and look at each one of those votes and count it that way. So there's three opportunities to do an audit.
These machines are not without controversy, though. The paper trail is on the roll, and some say this could present problems. David Jefferson from California had this to say. And who are you with, David?
Well, I represent essentially the Secretary of State of California here. I am a member of the Voting Systems and Procedures Panel of the State of California, which makes formal recommendations about certification of voting systems, and also a technical advisor to the Secretary of State of California.
There's a machine here from Nevada, which is a touchscreen machine, and I overheard that you, I talked with the fellow from the state, but I also wondered what you felt about it.
Well, so the machine here is a Sequoia AVC Edge voting machine, electronic voting machine that is equipped with a voter-verified paper trail printer unit on the side. And this was the first time I had seen this machine, although it was used in the November election throughout the state of Nevada. But I wanted to see this voter-verified paper trail unit. I had read the specs for the machine, but I had not seen one live. I have a number of concerns about it, and I would very much like to see Sequoia redesign this machine. My first concern is that the printer unit prints on paper it's a reel-to-reel design. There is a long, several hundred foot strip of paper that is that's fed from one reel and taken up from another, so that as the votes are printed for the voters to inspect, the order in which the votes are cast on that machine is perfectly preserved. And so if somebody observes which voters vote on which machines during the course of an election day, they can reconstruct who cast which ballot as recorded on this paper trail. I think this is a very poor design. I think it undermines voting privacy, and what we really need to do is to cut the paper between every two ballots and have the paper fall into a ballot box so the order is randomized.
Another issue that was discussed was polling place operations and poll workers. The lack of supervision and monitoring of election workers during the election process was observed by Ted Selker, an associate professor from MIT. He opened up his laptop in the hallway and showed me pictures he took while observing the primary in Nevada earlier this year using the AVC Edge Sequoia machine.
I'm Ted Selker. I'm the director of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project at MIT.
And I've been talking with people about the machine that was used in Nevada, and you say you have some interesting information.
Yeah, I watched it during the September primary, and I saw various things. One thing that you'll see in this photograph is that you can very clearly see the paper trail, which is good. They had high contrast. You notice they're all lined up in a row, and you'll see as we go through these pictures, that basically people are crammed together, and it's very difficult for them to have secrecy. This particular person here, this is the beginning of the day, at 7:09 a.m., she discovered that her voting machines weren't turned on, all 20 of them for two precincts. They had a lot of them there because they didn't want to have not enough. And you'll see her down on her knees writing down the beginning of day count. This is the day after Labor Day, and she has no one supervising her as she writes down how many people have voted in the past on this voting machine. So if she gets that wrong, in fact, we don't know if anybody voted on Labor Day while this was in this church. So I'm a little concerned about that. You'll see this is what's called the activator module. They have one of those over there. In the activator module, you have to put the card in, and then you write down a number. Now, you'll see this little strip of paper that's closest to her. It says Precinct 000 Democrat, and she types that in instead of accidentally, instead of typing in the paper higher, which says Precinct 516 Democrat. And so what happens is that people go and they try to vote, and I'll show you what it looks like. About 10 minutes in, you'll see this person sitting down. All these voters are standing around because they've all voted for senator and can't vote for anybody else. So because she didn't have any supervision in activating that smart card, she is accidentally given everybody provisional ballots and doesn't realize it. That doesn't get corrected until 10 o'clock in that precinct.
So the problem with that could be that the provisional ballots, since they're provisional ballots and the people are registered somewhere else, they can be thrown out maybe.
No, it's worse than that. What it means is that all these people in this primary only get to vote for the federal, the senator, instead of for all the seven other things that they're voting for on that day. So all those people, they'll be counted, but what will be bad is that instead of getting to vote for the things they came in to vote for, and they were unhappy in it, you saw them sitting there patiently waiting to vote, they don't get to do that. What you'll notice about this voting machine in the same precinct is it has a red screen on it. And with that red screen, I took a picture of it because it basically said battery low. When you see battery low on a machine that's just turned on, this one in front of a window so that it has bad contrast, what it really means is that isn't plugged in. And it turns out in that precinct, all 20 machines were plugged into one circuit which had blown before the day started. And so about an hour later, they all shut down. They then plugged it into an outlet in the kitchen, which had a microwave plugged into it, and for some reason no one turned on that microwave all day and those machines didn't go down again. So what I'm telling you is the polling place operations are just often a real big problem, and I don't think that these guys are unusual, by the way.
Ted Selker even had more issues, as one out of 20 machines will jam the printer roll. And you're supposed to replace the printer, but one woman had taken the printer roll out, cut it, without supervision in another room, and he never really found out whether she had taped it back together or thrown it into the box to be a paper trail later on. In Ted Selker's opinion, everything that happens in the voting room is a voting machine. And his other warning was that fraud follows the technology, so we must continue to be vigilant. Not everyone who attended this forum or either of the forums was a great fan of the voting machines. I had the opportunity to talk with one woman who had this to say about paper ballots.
My name is Lynn Landis.
Lynn, why did you come here today?
Well, I'm a freelance journalist. I've been writing about this for over 2 years now, the issue of voting systems and democracy. Plus, I filed two federal lawsuits, one against the use of any and all voting machines and the other against the use of absentee ballots. And on the latter, that is not to say that people who are away from home couldn't vote, but I suggest that they be voting in a precinct where there's some security and integrity to the process. Because if you mail in your ballot or you vote early, you've left your vote really in the hands of an election official who may be fairly unscrupulous, as we have come to find out.
You mentioned paper ballots in your question to the panel. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, first I want to say that with these conferences have been organized by the Voter Verified groups and Common Cause, ACLU and others, they never include on the panel anyone who is against the machines and for paper ballot only elections. And that happens to be the way paper ballot only elections, hand counts, hand manual counts, is the way 95% of all the nations on earth vote. We are in the extreme minority with our really short-sighted use of voting machines. And we've been using them for over 100 years. So we really don't know what kind of government we would have if we had direct access to a tangible ballot and we were able to observe a manual hand count. That is really best called the Australian paper ballot method. It was created in 1856. It was introduced to this country about 1888, but it was in the 1870s that absentee voting was introduced for soldiers, and it was in the 1890s that voting by machine was introduced. So by the 1930s, most large cities had these voting machines. When people talk about the Chicago rigged elections, they're not talking about paper ballots. They're talking about, they don't realize this, but it's about voting machines, not ballot boxes. So we have this huge myth that we can't trust people to count ballots, but we can trust machines, completely non-transparent machines, to count ballots.
What do you say to people who would say that it's important to have the election results as fast as possible?
Well, you can have that. It's, again, we have these false choices that we're being presented. You can certainly have a quick count. The speed of the count depends on the length of the ballot and the number of election officials you have on hand to count those ballots. We could draft people for that duty just like we do for jury duty. The exact same thing. It's not a matter of cost. It's not a matter of volunteers. It's a matter of a civic responsibility and duty. This is not rocket science. But for whatever reason, the voting rights groups have teamed together with the computer industry and the voting machine vendors and the state election directors to foist on the American public this really complex, confusing, diabolical technology. Now, one thing, you don't even have to rig these voting machines to disrupt an election, as we saw in this past election. All you have to do is make them fail. And so if they fail or they're just malfunctioning, running on three cylinders instead of four, you've effectively disrupted an election. And I will tell you where these machines malfunctioned and failed. It was in the minority communities. And they'll do it every time. And they've done it in the past. So attaching ballot printers, this voter verified option, is not going to protect voters. It's not going to give them back their right to vote.
On election day, there were widespread allegations of voter suppression, irregularities, and fraud in Ohio and around the nation. There were long lines, misdirection of voters, machines that broke down, and there were not enough machines in many precincts. All these irregularities took place in predominantly poor and minority precincts. Another issue was the original exit poll data, which was replaced with calibrated polls that reflected the voting results that eventually were used in Ohio. Many people spoke to this issue.
Thank you, Congressman Connors. My name is Jonathan Simon. I'm a former political survey research analyst, and I was primarily the one who was responsible for downloading the exit polling data while it was still pure. My colleague Steve Freeman initially used to work with and expose some of the anomalies. My question is to the panel, and to enlarge a bit upon what Congressman Watt mentioned before when he read into the record the absence of the majority members of this committee. And that is, do you realize what is at stake? And by what I mean by that is, if you look at the catch-22 of a democracy, when you've messed with its bedrock protocol, which is the vote and the ability to count the vote, we can get very upset about that in this room and outside this room. And by being upset about that, what we would do then is put pressure on Congress, legislature, and certainly on your colleagues who are not in this room. And if they refuse to respond to that pressure, what we would then do in a democracy is go down to the voting places, our precincts, in 2006 and say, we're going to make them pay. We're going to vote them out of office. And we can't do that if they don't count our votes. And they won't count our votes as long as they own the machines. So what's at stake is the death of democracy. What we're dealing with here, although the formality is all in place, is a stuffed animal, not a real animal. Taxidermic model of democracy. And I just want to ask if that's been absorbed, that this is not about Bush and Kerry, or even the senators who may have been rigged out of their seats. This is about the future of democracy, and it is a critical emergency. Thank you.
Thank you for your statement. Many more people involved with statistical analysis say that all the problems and irregularities could not have happened by chance. Shauna Walcott, communications director from Zogby International, said that there were unprecedented levels of suspicion. Throughout both days as well, people talked about Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State in Ohio.
Why were there so many people in line in urban, poor areas, community of colors, when the voter registration was so high everywhere in the country? You go into the suburbs, the exurbs, there were no lines, because that's one witness said to us in Cuyahoga County, we had fewer voting machines on election day than we had on primary day, fewer machines in 2004 than in 2000. Mr. Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Ohio, does earn the Catherine Harris Award of 2004.
Throughout both days, people voiced their concern and frustration about media reports that everything was fine at the polls on November 2nd. Some people went as far as to say that there was a media blackout. They said the mainstream media had not done its job of reporting the irregularities, and they were very pleased that C-SPAN attended and was taping and showing this forum live, and also that other members of the media were present to try to get this story out. Wade Henderson from the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights had this to say.
We attracted perhaps as many as between 400 and 500 participants, rather people in the audience who just came to hear the discussion, to ask questions, and because of C-SPAN and Low Power FM and other stations covering this issue, we think that the message will get out to the American people, and that will further prod reform in this upcoming 109th Congress.
In the last few years, people have turned more and more to alternative press and foreign reports for information about what is happening in the U.S. William Rivers Pitt, managing editor of TruthOut.org, was at the Conyers hearing, and I asked him about this. What did you think about today's hearing?
Overall, I thought it was incredibly productive to get. First of all, I loved that there were 14 news cameras in the room, plus the Pacifica Radio simulcast, so that this wasn't merely a number of people who know about this stuff talking to themselves and talking to the walls. This will leave this room and get out, hopefully, a little bit farther out into the mainstream media. There's been a fairly significant blackout on these stories that have come out of Ohio, out of Florida, out of Virginia, about voting irregularities. And I think that this forum will push that farther out into the mainstream.
I'm in Low Power FM. You're in alternative media. How do we practice corporate media stranglehold on the information?
We don't. We just make them irrelevant. We're never going to crack the corporate media. They're never going to report on anything that cuts directly against their own best interest. They're never going to report on the supposed victory of a party, a Democratic Party or a progressive majority that would like to see their empires re-regulated. They're not going to report on anything like that. Companies like General Electric aren't going to report through their NBC and MSNBC affiliates that their enterprise in Iraq, which General Electric is making a lot of money off of, is not going so well. We're not going to crack that facade. We're going to make them irrelevant. We're going to turn television news into something about as profound and as important as infomercials. And we're just going to do it by keep on doing what we're doing and letting people know that there is an alternative for people who want more than just fluff and fuzz for their news.
The message was repeated many times during both these forums that the people of America must be vigilant, stay informed, and keep the drumbeat sounding. It is necessary to put pressure on the government to admit that there are problems with the election process. I asked Congressman Melvin Watt from North Carolina how people can make a difference.
You made it a point to go on the record to make sure that people knew that Republican representatives and everybody had been invited to this, and the response was that they had refused. But you also alluded, you also said that there is a way to get things done in Congress, and I was wondering, what can the people of America do to help you get that message across to him?
Well, they can write to the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and say, we have serious concerns about whether democracy worked in this election, and we need the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives to take those concerns seriously and to act on them.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Since my trip to Washington for these two events, John Conyers has traveled to Columbus, Ohio with others to hear firsthand from more citizens about their experiences on Election Day 2004. Lawsuits are pending, many brought forth by ordinary citizens who are witness to suppression. John Bonifaz, General Counsel for the National Voting Institute, summed it up best in his closing remarks. This is Stanley Longstaff, WSCA LP, Portsmouth, 106.1 FM.
Mahatma Gandhi once said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. They are no longer ignoring us. They are no longer laughing at us. They're fighting us now, and we're going to win. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves on WSCA 106.1 FM. Thanks to Stanley Longstaff for that report on the DC event about election irregularities. Speaking of elections, let's take a moment to think about December 20th, 1952, which was the day that the Convention on the Political Rights of Women was opened for signature and ratification by the UN. The United Nations enacted the Covenant on Political Rights of Women in 1952. It was the first instrument of international law to state that in all nations, women should be entitled to the vote and to hold political office. The convention states that recognizing that everyone has the right to take part in the government of his country directly or indirectly through freely chosen representatives and has the right to equal access to public service in his country and desiring to equalize the status of men and women in the enjoyment and exercise of political rights in accordance with the provisions of the Charter of the UN and of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Having resolved to conclude a convention for this purpose, hereby agree, as in hereafter provided. I'll just read you the first three articles. Article 1. Women shall be entitled to vote in all elections on equal terms with men, without any discrimination. Article 2. Women shall be eligible for election to all publicly elected bodies established by national law, on equal terms with men without any discrimination. Article 3. Women shall be entitled to hold public office and to exercise all public functions established by national law on equal terms with men, without any discrimination. Now, this was only created in 1952, and at this point there are still nations which do not give suffrage, the right to vote, to women. These include Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Oman, Equatorial Guinea, Hong Kong, and Taiwan.
December 18th is the anniversary of the UN Migrant Rights Convention. The UN Migrant Rights Convention, officially known as the UN Convention on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and Members of Their Families, is the first international treaty to specifically address the issues of migrants. The convention extends the protection of fundamental human rights to all migrant workers and their families, including both documented and undocumented in status. The United Nations General Assembly approved the convention on December 18, 1990, and was brought into force when East Timor became the 20th nation to ratify the treaty on December 10, 2002. The UN Migrant Rights Convention provides a set of binding international standards to address the treatment, welfare, and human rights of both documented and undocumented migrants, and the obligations and responsibilities on the part of the sending and receiving states. It extends the concept of equality of treatment between nationals and non-nationals, between women and men, migrant workers, and between documented and undocumented workers. Overall, the convention seeks to play a role in preventing and eliminating the exploitation of all migrant workers and members of their families throughout the entire migration process. In particular, it seeks to put an end to the illegal or clandestine recruitment and trafficking of migrant workers and to discourage the employment of migrant workers in an irregular or undocumented situation. Finally, the convention establishes mechanisms for its implementation which provide new opportunities for increased participation from the global community to protect the rights of migrants. The United States has not signed on to this treaty. Next, we're going to have a request from a couple weeks ago that we didn't get around to. It's from The Mob Project, Musicians to Oust Bush. Last time we played Utah Phillips' track called From the Bottom Up. This time we're going to play From the Top Down by Utah Phillips.
Well, the political situation sits on top of all of our heads. You know, I've always said that the long memory is the most radical idea in America. Well, it's the most radical idea in the world. That long memory carries me back to the Weimar Republic, Germany, with the rise of the Nazis, the rise of fascism, it's in its nascent stages, right at the beginning. And then it came, you know, it grew and it grew and it grew, and it wasn't stopped, it wasn't stopped. And finally it took over, and we know what the consequences of that were. So, yes, it's pretty dire. What we've experienced is a corporate takeover of the executive branch of the government. The mega corporations have always tried, through lobbying, through outright bribes, through campaign contributions and so on, to control the government. Well, now they've sort of staged a coup on the executive branch that's behaving like a corporation. Corporate fascism, we're in it. We are in it, and we are of it. Look, when I ask young people, like I did down here at Placer High, I said to them, how many of the choices you make during the day about things like food, clothing, shelter, transportation, entertainment, and so on, how many of those choices are made by corporations or made by the states? More of one or more of the other? Is it more corporations? And they all put their hands up and said, yeah, it is. So they said, now, are corporations represented by elected people? Well, no. They put their hands up and said, no. Are corporations democratic institutions? Well, of course not. No, they're not. They're hierarchical institutions. It's shut up and do what you're told institutions. Are corporations anti-democratic institutions? I mean, do they hire companies to help bust the union? Do they try to drive the union out? Do they try to get the wages down as far as they possibly can without any benefits? Well, yeah, that's true. So I said, okay, you just told me that the majority of the decisions that affect your life day to day are made by non-elected people representing anti-democratic institutions. Fascism is here. It's not something we worry about coming. Fascism is here. Question is, what are we going to do about it? I do know now that these people in Washington are not Republicans and they're not Democrats. They're a different kind of thing. They're a different kind of thing. They are fascist ideologues. And they're the most dangerous people the country and maybe the world has ever seen. And they've got to get out of there. We've got to get them out of there. The only institution that has the organized strength to do that is the Democratic Party. It galls me to say that. There's no love lost between me and the Democratic Party or any party as far as that goes. But they're the only one that has the power to do that. Unfortunately, the Democratic Party seems to be committed to assassinating itself. It is long since past time for these Democratic candidates to get together, sit down quietly in a room by themselves and decide among themselves who the hell can get elected and put everything they've got, their constituencies and their fundraising base together. It's long past time when every progressive organization in the country, from animal rights to the feminist movement to peace, anti-nuclear, every progressive force in this country has got to come together for once in one united front. We stop hammering on each other. Stop confining ourselves to our own gig. Oh, that's not my issue. No, this is all of our issue right now. And if we don't build a united front, we're going to be marching lockstep into heavy-duty fascism. That's looking at it from the top down. And, of course, I get frightened when I do that. I get frightened when I take the world from the top down.